67, I guess. And one of the very first things that happened was Chris came and proposed that we support the boycott, and I really should find for you the wording for that, because it was a very important thing. I remember that it was specifically to boycott the grapes of 5 or 6 named companies mm-hmm. at that particular time. And it seemed like a very easy thing to do. But we took that
especially
action.
Especially for the Methodists.
And the whole thing descended. I mean, those churches in the valley just began to raise Ned, and the whole thing. Dick Norberg, I don't know if you were able to get a hold of Dick.
I am. I'm going to meet with him tomorrow.
Well, I think Dick, of all the people that I was associated with, can probably put it in the best kind of this thing I'm talking about now. I went down the valley with him a number of times. He traveled all the time. But the thing we discovered was that by and large, it's the big growers that were dominating the scene, were calling the shots, and the little grower was taken in by all of this. The big grower was fighting it, you know, on a dollar, from a dollar point of view. The small grower, by and large, it was a life and death matter in a sense. And they couldn't control the costs of planting or anything like that. They couldn't control the costs of fertilizing and all of those things. They couldn't control the cost of what they got for their product. But one thing they could control, in a sense, was how much they paid the workers. And all of a sudden, along comes, this communist who was trained by Saul Alinsky and, all the things that were said to organize the people. The one thing that they could do, we could control. At least that's what Dick and I sort of figured. And the little growers, who are the backbone of most of our churches up and down the valley, just couldn't understand at all how the council could do that.
As you think back, what did trying to get at some of the key factors that people were really upset with? Are you indicating that one of the key factors was that they felt like the church was deserting them mm-hmm. in a basic sense about how they make their livelihood?
Yeah, that the church was taking away their profits, you know. I mean, most of them are. We discovered a lot of things that most of them loved the land, loved the farming, but really weren't making a go of it. Very often the wife was teaching school or was a secretary or something like that. Sometimes even the grower himself had part-time jobs. And, he just barely, I'm talking about a lot of people, may not have been a majority, but a lot of our church people were just barely hanging on. And they had, 20, 30, 40, maybe 100 acres. And they were completely at the mercy of the big growers. I mean, there's just no way they could pack and ship their own stuff. But they just saw the church as just taking away their livelihood. And I think that at the same time, Cesar Chavez was being painted in the kind of thing that I alluded to a minute ago. I mean, I was told many times that, that he was a communist. And, that he was trained by Saul Alinsky. And I suppose it's the name Saul Alinsky. I spent a lot of time with him. Do you know Bill Grace?
No.
He was the Presbyterian urban person for a number of years in this area. And Bill Grace brought him. We had a week-long seminar with Saul Alinsky at Selemar 1 year. I brought him out with the Methodist urban pastors when I was superintendent. And
what was it about Saul Alinsky that people assumed that anyone associated or trained by him were communists?
Well, you know, from my point of view, Saul Alinsky was almost like a medicine man. I mean, he just... I'm not sure he had any great philosophical kind of thing, but he used these tactics that just turned off, you know, the nice people in our churches.
Pressure, confrontation.
Well, here in Oakland, for instance, he met a lot of the leaders, was going to do some organizing here, and they met him at the airport and didn't want him to come in and so on. And he had a lot of little diapers made and mailed to all of them, and said they were, this is for the crybabies. And of course, one time there was going to be a big community meeting, sort of in opposition to him. And he said he was going to have all his followers eat beans for 3 days and go there and stink up the place. And you know, it's tactics like that. Get to our nice church people. He would, just all kinds of stuff that he used in his...
But what do you suppose was the reason, though, that people would say, well, Caesar was a communist? Did you ever figure that out, what was behind that?
Well, I think one thing about Saul Alinsky was the name Alinsky. I mean, it sounds like Trotsky or... any of the other skis, you know. The man himself is so disarming in the person-to-person contact. But when he started organizing, he really was, could be a terror, you know. He just, any tactic he believed with that accomplished your end, and he wouldn't mind who he worked with, you know, whether they were communists or not. In fact, one of the things he taught was that you need alliances if you're going to get anything done. You have to find people.
For yourself, did you find that that Caesar, as he developed, you know, the organizing tactics of the Union, how did you feel yourself about the kinds of tactics that he used?
Well, I think by and large he did very well. He used a lot of Alinsky methods and so on. I mean, in terms of putting pressure on people and threats and so on. But by and large there was violence, but I don't think Caesar ever promoted violence or was in favor of violence. And, you know, by and large, I just think he was pretty solid. I remember one time we had an interesting experience. We went out into Delano, one of the meetings, and Saul Alinsky had back trouble for a while. He was flat in bed right then. You may remember that time.
Mm-mm.
And... So five or six of us went over to see him.
You're talking about Saul or Caesar?
No, excuse me.
Caesar. Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
When Caesar was flat in bed. And he said, what are you doing? And we told him that we had delegations going to the Methodist Church and Episcopal Church and so on and talking to people. And he said, isn't anybody going to the Catholic Church? And said, no. And he said, well, what about you people? And said, well, we were chosen to come and see you instead of going to one of these church groups. And he said, I want you to call up the priest over to church. And so we called up right from his house, and the woman who answered talked to the priest, and he said he would be glad to see us. They just said we were from, I forgot what said. But anyway, migrant ministry, I guess. And So it was a hot day. He'd taken off his coat. He invited us in. There were maybe five of us. And so pretty soon came around and he said, "Are you connected with Cesar Chavez?" And we said, "Yes, we've just come from his home." And he said, "Well, he doesn't belong to this church, you know. He belongs to the church way out and the other side." I said, "Well, yes, but he lives in your parish. You know, he lives about five or six blocks from here." And he said, I'm neutral. I don't take sides in this." And it was the most interesting thing because he just got us out of that house as fast as he could. It was obvious that the pressures in that church, he probably had the grower types in the downtown church.
Oh, yeah, that was the downtown one.
And the people belonged to the church for Caesar. They were mostly Mexicans and Filipinos, I guess, out of the fringes.
Your father was in farming?
No.
No?
My father was in a company that made agricultural equipment, though. You know, canning equipment and sprayers for orchards and pumps for water.
Did you come from the San Joaquin Valley yourself?
No, born and raised in San Jose.
Oh,
my dad moved out to there when he was 10, lived there till he was 99.
Oh my gosh.
But developed one of the largest businesses that developed there.
What was it that made it difficult for you personally to accept those changes? Can you remember what it...
Oh, yeah, I think... This is one of the problems, I think, with the church universally, that we're... You know, I was brought up in a about as fine a Christian home as you can imagine. You know, you didn't do anything to hurt people. I had a hard time dealing with any kind of conflict because, you know, I didn't like conflict. And by and large, I never had conflict growing up in home or community or a church or anywhere else. And I think most of our good Christian people, well, just look at the whole way the World Council of Churches fund to combat racism, for instance. When it takes sides on anything, immediately the churches have a hard time. And I think it was, you know, giving up this, doing these nice things for the farm workers, which really didn't benefit them. Except for the moment, like sending food over to Ethiopia. We don't deal with the real problems. Next year is going to be just as bad as this year. And I think it was one of the real learning experiences for me in my ministry, you know, total ministry, not just in terms of the farm worker business, but to learn that people in power aren't going to give that up. And the only way they're going to even talk to the people, it's the hardest thing I've spent a lot of time. I have a friend who's now retired, but he was with the Bank of America in a very top job. And to talk with him, people in that position are working for the stockholders, for the employees, and for the good of everybody from their point of view. But that means that the people who don't have much don't get much help from a bank or from anywhere else, from the church even, as far as that's concerned. And Glide, for instance, just has a whole senior power thing, and they put pressure on the city and on the, you know, they can get carload, they can get 100 cars to go to Sacramento and so on, and just empowering people that don't have power. And I just think it's a concept that I've never run into till this incident mm-hmm. happened, this action that the council took. And my own father cornered me next time I went down and said, you either ought to get them to change that or you ought to resign. And the worst argument I had with my dad was over this mm-hmm. issue. I remember going down to Fresno, and it was at the time that the new bishop, Episcopal bishop, was being installed. And my brother is a good Republican, and Nixon was there running for governor. And he said, come on to this rally. And a good friend of the family saw me there. He climbed over chairs, so he got up and he said, Cliff, what the hell are you letting that council do? You know, that's the way it started. And he said, you know, he just really, it was a good time and place, I suppose, at a Nixon rally for that to happen.
It's hard, though, for people who have been trained to not get into conflict, to deal with all the conflict then engenders.
Well, one other thing that happened, I don't know if it would be of interest to you, but one day a pastor friend, a Methodist pastor from Sanger, walked into the council office right past the secretaries, everybody, opened the door to my office and walked in and said, Cliff Crummy, I want you to know that I'm collecting money and we're going to sue the council for all the damage that you've done to churches over here. And he said, the Valley churches are hurting. You've cut the number of people who are giving. And, oh, he just went. The thing he had already started was sending letters to churches up and down to get a fund to sue the council. And he said he had done research and knows that we did not have a quorum present when that action was taken. And I would say parenthetically, we went right out and got our lawyer to come in and go through our minutes and the count, and we were confident that we were legal. But anyway, the difficult thing was that this, I knew that this minister had mental problems. And I couldn't say that to the people in the office. I couldn't say that to the officers of the council even. I mean, I just had to take it at face value. He has since had to leave the ministry and has been hospitalized off and on. And I knew all of this, you know. I'd been a district superintendent and I'd been involved in the appointments. So that I knew that he was, that this might not last very long, and yet I knew that he was capable. He had a father who was a very well-to-do man, so he had money of his own and so on. So that was one of the most...
Whatever happened to that suit?
Well, it never happened, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember how. No suit ever was filed.
Is he manic depressive?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
that?
he was a very, very sick man.
Volatile.
Brilliant fella.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant fella. I think he still lives in Sanger. Last I heard.
What was the, as you remember back, what was the role that Chris played with those of you that were involved?
Well, of course, Chris, Chris had been involved in the whole ministry for a long time. I think he had very great respect, you know, for people generally. So that I think in that period, you know, we would have done anything that he suggested that we ought to do. And he was really magnificent through this whole thing. He, of course, very soon especially in the Presbyterian churches down that valley, they didn't even want him anywhere near. They didn't even want him to drive through because he became so controversial. And it's interesting. I found the same thing about me, you know. And I've been about as conservative a person most of my life that I could imagine. And pretty soon they were talking about me the same way, you know. I mean, that they didn't want the council. Several of them withdrew from the council. I mentioned going down to Fresno, the installation of this bishop. And I sat in the back row and didn't even say I was there, and wrote him a note and said I was there afterwards because he didn't want me around. And, you know, it would be embarrassing to him because of Episcopal people. But back to Chris, I really think that that the transition, few people could have carried out what happened. And Chris did it on the strength of, number one, his long involvement and very careful preparation. This didn't happen overnight. It was very careful preparation. Chris didn't use strong tactics. It was all out in the open. I suppose he's capable of getting mad and so on, but you know, in these sessions, he just carried it off so wonderfully that he'd done homework with a lot of people. Carl Urban was one of. Did you ever get a hold of him?
I got a hold of Ethelyn, his wife. And we're going to try to find a time, but we haven't found one.
Well, they would be eager to do it. I mean, they...
He did write me a note, so we're trying to find
a
time.
Well, I would say of all the people I can think of up here, he would be about as important. One of the stories I want to tell you, I don't know whether this is important or not, but we decided we ought to go down to the valley and listen to the church people. So we had I think it was in Sanger, but I'm not sure, near Fresno. And we were driven by a man by the name of White. I can't think of his first name, but he was working fundraising for the National Council of Churches. And he always drove a great big car. He had one of these great big 7-passenger Cadillacs. Not a new one, but he just liked a big car. So he took us down. And I mentioned to you over the phone, I think, this fellow Smith, who has since died, who was the vice president of the council. The president was Bishop Millard, and he was out of the country when all this happened. But Smith went. Nellie Kratz, has her name come up?
Yes.
Do you remember Nellie?
I remember Nellie.
Well, Nellie and I was there. I'm not sure I can put together the group. I think there were 5 or 6 of us. And we went down to this meeting, and one after another got up and spoke and told us how wrong we were, and that we ought to rescind that it was the very lifeblood of the valley and of the church people and so on. We listened to this for...
This is rescinding the action to support that wine boycott?
Yeah, the boycott. And, but anyway, this was a long, long, hard session. You know, it went 3 hours maybe. And in a church sanctuary, with people just getting up and telling us how wrong we were. Well, Nellie Kratz had stayed overnight. Her husband had been minister of the First Baptist Church in Fresno. And she stayed with some friends who work at Fresno State in the agricultural department. And they had raised a whole bunch of grapes, you know, the students. So she got in the car, and she had these bags of grapes. None of us had eaten any grapes for 2 years, maybe. And she had these grapes, and gave us a whole bunch of plastic bags so we could divide them up. And we got to talking about on the way home, what if we should have an accident and all be killed and be covered with grapes? How would we explain that? Last time Nellie was out, she lives in Connecticut now, last time she was out, we were talking about that. It was, she said, now they're raised by students, you know, they're no involvement at all, they're grapes that we can eat, and we were eating grapes all the way home.
Had the council taken a position on the grape boycott as such?
Well, that's what the action was.
Okay, it was the grape boycott.
It was to support the boycott of, I think it was six named. Was that specific an action?
Okay, so that was like Pirelli, Minetti, and some of those.
Well,
probably some of those.
I have no memory at all of that. Valley. But it seems to me that the action was taken, I think it was June or July. It was in the summer, and we did have, you know, very few people there. It's less than you'd have. But, it seemed like such an innocent thing to support the boycott of... The migrant ministry, as such, had become organizing arm of the union. We had gone through that step. And, the next step was to support the boycott of these ones where they were at the moment. Trying to put pressure, and I can remember going into stores and asking to see the boxes, you know, that the grapes came in and so on, and that's what we tried to do, trying to get people to do, to be that selective, because at that time there were grapes that, but far as we were concerned, we just didn't buy any grapes.
Mm-hmm.
True of an awful lot of people. Didn't eat any grapes for about 2 or 3 years.
I remember my little girl, she'd have to inquire from time to time what that kind of fruit was called. She'd forget what it was called.
She didn't see them at home either. Where were you in this period of time?
We were in Los Angeles. We were in a suburban, my husband was serving a suburban church. With him. There was you became the director in 60, and then how long were you the director?
Oh no, you mean that I
of,
was
of the I, of the of the Northern California Council?
No, I wasn't. It was I was 60 to 66. I was the Methodist superintendent.
Oh, okay.
And then
and then 67.
In 66, they put together an urban portfolio for me, so that then Walter Press was the UCC one, Bill Grace, the Presbyterian, and so, and there were five of us who were full-time urban staff people representing our denominations, and that's when we put together JSAC, mm-hmm. our Joint Strategy and Action mm-hmm. Committee, or we had put it together before that, but we were the staff people. And then what happened was, let's see, it must have been 68, the end of 67, that Paul Shelford retired, announced he was going to retire, and they started to search, and I was asked to be the executive director. And this urban team, we were working together on all kinds of stuff, and they just said, here's our chance to take over the Northern California Council of Churches. And we did. I mean, we completely reorganized it when I left. We had changed the name, Northern California Ecumenical Council, the year I left. And we decided that our future was in becoming related to all of the various groups. You know, we'd started with the migrant, we had the migrant ministry and the California Parks Ministry and American Bible Society and a lot of things like that. Well, all of, and then we began to pick up all of these things that were around largely single issue things that began to come up. And we set up a council table, which all of these were related. And we now have, I think it's 37 units and that are related to the council. But this grew out really of this bunch that Walter Press is, will tell you a lot about too, I'm sure.
So how long did you serve as the executive?
Less than 5 years. I always say 5 years, but I started. And the year that I came on, the National Council, I don't know if you remember this, had a great big special meeting in San Diego on the whole urban crisis. And I remember I went to that, even though I was not executive yet. And sort of represented the council. And, well, I tell you, those were some times.
Do you think back with the migrant ministry during the years where there was so much conflict, what were your main sources of for keeping informed, keeping on top of things?
Well, of course, basically the stuff that came from the migrant ministry and going to the meetings. I usually went to the meetings, you know, that ones we're talking about that were held in Covenant Church and very often Delano, so on. Plus the fact of Nellie Kratz, Carl Irvin, I'd say both of them being disciples. Well, I don't know if you've run across the name Bill Dew. Bill Dew.
He was a pastor in San Joaquin Valley, wasn't he?
He was Methodist? Clovis. At that time. This is a little side, he's now over at Alamo, just a few miles from here. They're very good friends. But I hadn't even met him until a meeting at, I think it was Delano, but a committee of three had been set up to write, I thought of it in this connection, to write why we support the union organizing. They were really to do the apology, you know, and using a good historical term. Mm-hmm. And three people, and two of them never helped at all. Bill did his, they were each going to write a statement, then they were going to get together, and the other two never wrote them. And I remember Bill, this young minister, out of a valley church coming down there with his statement, which was then adopted by the migrant ministry as you know, a statement why the churches should support. And of course Bill had a hard time because his church was full of farmers and it's on the fringe of Fresno, the metropolitan area. Now it's getting closer to the middle of the city all the time. The city grows, that church.
Do you have a sense, as you think back, of the role that the migrant ministry as an entity, and later the National Farm Worker Ministry, played in keeping the farm worker movement hooked up with the churches?
Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of churches, of course, that didn't want anything to do with the National Farm Worker Ministry after that because of the fact that it was controversial. But I think, you know, at least from the point of view of Chris and the team of people that were working north and south, in California, they kept the communications open all the time, even though there were churches that were closed. I remember, I'm not sure whether Chris told me that. I think it was in the Bakersfield area. He came up for something. And several of the Presbyterians just said, now, if you come up for that, we don't want you to... we don't want the information that you're a Presbyterian minister. We don't want you relating to our churches. It was a very, very hard thing to play any kind of a mediating role when you'd chosen to be on one side of the issue. And yet the choice was deliberate. I mean, that's where I chose to be.
And what do you think would have happened if there had not been a migrant ministry?
Well, I don't see where the church, how the churches could have been much support if it hadn't been for the migrant ministry. Because it was there, it had been concerned about people's welfare, and that team of people became convinced that the only way to help them long range was to get them into the mainstream of American life and not be the fringe people. Mm-hmm. And I think that was enough people. It was a powerful group in Northern California, and I'm sure it was in Southern California too. I mean, many of the real decision makers and denominational heads and so on. So it was a powerful lobby. Mm-hmm. And it was in existence before all of this happened. I just doubt if the church could have rallied. I've heard Caesar say two or three times that he could never have done it without the migrant ministry.
I'm intrigued by what we might be able to deduce for other situations from that situation. That's one of the things I'm really interested in. And whether we could... whether there's anything to be learned in terms of our church structures about mm-hmm. having mm-hmm. that ecumenical agency that didn't rely on one denomination or one major source for its support and therefore had a better chance of riding out all the conflict. It interests me, and I don't know if there's something we could learn from that or not.
Yeah, the thing... I'm also convinced that things are cyclical. I mean, you can only carry people, keep enthusiasm going a certain length of time, and then it's sort of, you need to pick up at a different point or something else. Mm-hmm. I think the whole hunger, I think the church has learned from migrant minister and other things about the hunger issue, and there are more and more people I find around who are hunger swept all our churches, you know, back, is it as much as 10 years now, and we were all doing these things, women's groups, anybody, but then to start doing something about the economics or political things that are the cause of this great hunger. And you narrow it down by 99% of the people who are willing to say, yes, I'll do something about these American corporations that are going out and keeping people poor, or the political situation, or whatever it is. Now, I'll admit it's not as easy to do something about Ethiopia as it is to do something about the farm workers. I mean, they're here, they're... You can see the whites of their eyes. Mm-hmm. While Ethiopia, with the standoff between the Soviet and the Western world, and, you know, the things are just so complicated.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think we've learned... And the thing that worries the heck out of me now is the rise of the conservative churches to such power. Because I think the National Council and the World Council, without doubt, both of them were invaded, of course, by the migrant ministry, by the National Farm Worker Ministry, and were great support. And learned from them. And I think, you know, it's evident what's going on. But I don't know that you saw this poll that was made of all U.S. Senators and congressmen by this conservative press, and Senator Cranston came out zero. And the things they judged on, there were 10 of them, and I should remember them all, on stand on abortion, on support of military buildup. These are Christian principles. Prayers in the school, you know,
the usual
there are
things.
Millions of church people that are going to judge our senator by Christian principles, which I don't think are, you know, necessarily Christian or military buildup.
Hard to understand, isn't it?
Oh, jeez. But, you know, that's invading. It really is.
Going back for a minute to Caesar, in your own experience, what role did Caesar play in either attracting or not attracting support?
Yeah. Well, Caesar, you know, I'd say much the same thing I said about Chris. Caesar, I would say I've seen him only, been with him 5 or 6 times. But every time, I remember hearing him going to Mass at Delano. The first time I ever took communion in a Roman Catholic service, I've been to many of them, but I usually just didn't take communion because I just knew it was not what you should do. But they wanted the solidarity there, you know. I mean, wanted us to, and so I went and took communion in Mass in that Catholic church there out on the fringe of Delano. And Caesar was always very prominent there. And, you know, these people who talked to me about his being communist, and I would describe his participation in the Mass and what was said about him and so on, you know, this is awful hard for people to swallow. But Caesar, in person, I'm talking about how I view in person and what he wrote and the way he directed that, was on principles I could support. That's not everything that happened, but he always was non-violent. He was always supporting people who were, you know, on the fringes of society.
So you didn't, with those basics, you found it comfortable and that it fit with your own theological training.
Oh, yeah. I just, well, I really will have to say that I, in the 60s, I did a complete flip in terms of politics and where I stood on issues and so on. I mean, just about as opposite as where I had been. And I had to do my theology all over again. Mm. I mean, the nice theological position I went to Boston University, mm-hmm. and then to Union Seminary in New York for a year. And then when I was a chaplain in the Navy, when I came out, I did a PhD at the University of Chicago. So, you know, I've really been around theological school a lot. Mm-hmm. And I just had to redo my theology. I really, that nice personalist theology that I learned at Boston just wasn't adequate for dealing with issues. so that, you know, in a sense, people like Chris and Caesar were part of my re-education.
So it's really had that, the context with them really has had a lasting effect then on you.
Oh,
and
definitely.
On your,
yeah, very good.
And was one of the factors in your theological.
At the same time,
change.
The Glide Foundation tackling some of the problems of the city, and again relating to helping to organize. There, it's really fun. There are two or three very important people in the life of San Francisco now that are people I saw picked up out of a housing project and asked to organize people. And, you know, a couple of women with practically no education or anything else but just some native ability were really strong factors in the political life of San Francisco that Glide went into these housing projects and helped them organize, and these people just simply emerged. And, you know, the same, mm-hmm. it's the same basic principle mm-hmm. that we're talking about with the union organizing, empowering people who don't have any power. And I really believe in it.
I never had put any names on my own theological perspectives, which, you know, were always there and developing and changing and so on. But in years since, I have read some in liberation theology, and it seems to me in some ways that it really has lots of application. Have you felt that at all?
That it has what?
Has application.
Oh, definitely.
To what was going on in those years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course, liberation theology grew out of this kind of struggle in mainly Latin America. And these are digressions, but Roy Sano, who's a, I don't know if you know the name, he taught at Pacific School of Religion, was elected bishop, in Denver.
Of course, I've seen his name, S-A-N-O.
He made a speech, his first major speech, in which he said that he supported liberation theology, and said that by and large, the evangelicals were giving support to oppressive regimes around the world. And our good news, the conservative movement in the Methodist Church, just picked it up and went after him and accused him, if he was for liberation theology, then he was for the use of force and so on. And they said that they wanted an apology for him for saying what they'd said about evangelicals. Well, it's simply true that by and large, you know, and he is on the hot seat, let me tell you. But he said that anybody, that it's, he said it's blasphemy for anybody to say that liberation theology is not Christian. And they, he used a word that strong.
He's in Washington?
In Denver.
In Denver. Jeez.
And of course, the one they've had for the last 8 years there, Mel Wheatley, supported the homosexual.
Yes.
He has a homosexual son.
Yes.
And they were so glad to get rid of him. Now they got one who's getting on the hot seat. But, you know, I'm not sure I buy liberation theology as the theology. But it's certainly a legitimate expression of the faith that mm-hmm. grows out of the life of people. And my wife and I went down to Nicaragua with a team a year ago last December. Mm-hmm. And the kind of thing, it just cleared through the Roman Catholic Church, of course, in Nicaragua. It's the kind of thing that is liberation theology. It isn't that well developed, of course, in the life of parishes, mm-hmm. but they study about Moses leading the children out, and our faith can lead us out of where we've been and where we can go.
Did you have any sense of of similarities between what has happened in Nicaragua and the farm worker movement? Or did you think much about it at the time?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I don't know that I could give similarities in that. Except, of course, the people that were on the outside are now running the place, but when you've got something as formidable as the United States government tearing you down.
Yeah, it's hard.
Oh, it really is just unbelievable that we're doing what we're doing.
Is there anything else that you would especially want me to know?
I'll probably think of things. I think we've covered the basic things. I'll never forget that meeting in which the migrant ministry, you know, abandoned its past and took a whole new direction.
You were at that meeting?
I was at that meeting.
And where was that?
Oh, I don't remember.
Was it in the valley somewhere?
I think it was down in Southern California. I'm not sure I can remember where that was.
Chris will remember.
Of course, it happened, you know, in stages, but there was, the decision came. And we set up the California Church Council in that same period, and I think it was the California Church Council action that I'm thinking about. That was an interesting little twist, too, that we decided that in addition to the Northern and Southern California Councils of Churches, we needed something that would cover the whole state. So we decided to set up California Church Council. And so we had our lawyer contact the corporation commissioner, whoever it was, in Sacramento. And they said we couldn't use that name because there was already a California Church Council. And when we got the articles of incorporation, a copy of them, it had been started back in the 30s with Mr. Gertie. I don't know, Mrs. Glide's brother. Mm-hmm. They were big. We're still getting income from his estate here in our council. And my father was one of the people who had helped to organize that and had been sitting there for years. We dusted it off and
reactivated
it.
Interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah. It was,
well, I'll try to get that date from Chris. See what he can tell me about it. It sounds like an interesting meeting to take note of.
And I was not important in all that. I mean, I was an innocent bystander. I voted. But I mean, I was not in any of the development. And I will have to say it was hard work for me to do that because I just was so sort of foreign to where I was.
Mm-hmm. And that was while you were still a DS.
I think it probably was, although I have the hardest time going back now. I think maybe it was while I was still, or it could have been in that interim when I was, that urban portfolio was set up. I had become the urban person for our conference, and the national church and the local conference set up a fund so that I could move from district superintendent into that job. Mm-hmm. And I was only there, you see, 2.5 years, I guess, something like that, before the council job opened. And by then, they'd begun to have money problems anyway. They were really glad to have my job disappear. And Bill Grace. I'm surprised you never knew Bill Grace.
Yeah, I don't know him.
Bill was the real ringleader in our whole urban thing up here. Mm. And he was one of these impulsive sort of guys that really got in bad way with the Presbyterians here. I think he's in Minneapolis now. Mm. But he just plain disappeared all of a sudden. He just, evidently, I didn't realize the political things that were going on.
He was a Presbyterian?
Mm-hmm. He was a Presbyterian staff person, urban work. And he, wanted all of us to put all of our urban stuff and support it and just do away with the departments in our churches.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Illingworth was the executive and was very supportive. He was president of the council. So, but I tell you, somewhere in the machinery things, the Presbyterian machinery,
mm-hmm.
and his successor just pulled out. We all agreed to stay in 3 years. They had to stay in for a whole year after they wanted to get out because Dave Illingworth insisted they be true to their,
mm-hmm.
their agreement.
In
fact, the person who was the successor is pastor of First Presbyterian Church that you can see right there. Right there.
That's the Presbyterian
that's
Church.
That's First Presbyterian.
And
That kind of orangey
yeah.
thing, that's the First Christian Church
okay.
where the migrant, where...
Where Fred, has his,
where Fred has his office.
And then I was at the Congregational Church.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't see it, but
yeah.
it's...
That's where I was, yeah.
You can see the kind of windows right through the Congregational Church. Is down
yeah.
this way.
Yeah, okay.
And that's the Jewish one with the kind of dome.
Yeah.
Through there.
You
can see San Francisco over there.
It's a very holy spot right here. I'm very impressed. Is that a Catholic church way over there?
That's the cathedral. That's a wonderful church. I think that's one of the most exciting worship services I've ever been in.
Mm.
The Father Osuna.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.